Hi, I'm Marcus Brotman, and you're listening to the Pingree Politics Podcast. On today's episode, we talk with Assistant Director of Development at the Native American Rights Fund. The NARF is a legal defense group which is predominantly concerned with the rights of Native Americans and Native American tribes. I hope you enjoy.
Hello, everybody. My name is Sean Mahal, and I'm here with Dallin Meavy, the Assistant Director of Development at the Native American Rights Fund. First off, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
So, Mr. Meavy, to provide a little bit of background, can you tell us a little bit about what the NARF is and a little bit about what it does?
Sure. So the Native American Rights Fund, although I'll say NARF for short, just because it's a little easier, has been around for over 50 years. They were started in the 70s, kind of at the, in the midst of a lot of civil rights movements and things. The Native American community was no stranger to marginalization, discrimination, and a lot of racist policies, trying to exert a lot of pressure on tribal communities in different states. And as part of that focus to assist tribes, the Native American Rights Fund was started as part of the California Indian Legal Defense Fund. And through a grant from like the Ford Foundation and some government grants, they were initially based out of California to assist a lot of the tribes there, but quickly realized that with over 500 federally recognized tribes, one adverse legal decision could potentially impact all of them. And so they quickly decided to relocate to Denver because it seemed a little more central to a lot of tribes. They got bigger quite quickly. And, sort of started to lay the foundation for what really became known as federal Indian law. And that's just the body of law that encompasses all things on the tribal, state, and federal level that have to do with law and policy in Indian country, what we call Indian country. Right now we're headquartered out of Boulder, Colorado. We've got offices in Washington, D.C., as well as in Alaska. We sort of do a lot of different types of things, and maybe we can get into that in a little bit. But we've really become known as kind of the premier legal advocacy nonprofit law firm for tribal communities, tribal issues, which encompasses all kinds of different aspects of the law as a whole.
I noticed on the website that there seem to be five priorities where NARC focuses on. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So our board consists of tribal leaders from across the country and into Alaska as well. And they sort of keep us abreast of any sort of issues that maybe different tribal communities are facing. And early on in NARF's history, they decided that there should be five priorities that kind of guide and direct the types of cases that we take. We can start with, well, we don't really take on anything that has to do with tribe versus tribes. There's always long histories between tribes, and we prefer to stay out of that kind of stuff. And we also don't really do anything with criminal justice. That's a very complicated body of law. And we just decided early on that was a whole nother realm that we should leave to some other individuals, because it can get very nuanced and very specific depending on the tribe, the state that they reside in, and so forth. So the priorities have kind of guided and directed our work. We've got large focuses right now on environmental work. We do a lot of water law, sacred site protection. We fight pipelines, not because we're opposed to pipelines per se, just where there's tribal interests at stake. For example, The Dakota Access Pipeline was one prime example that kind of got a lot of news a couple years ago, and we're still fighting that fight, actually. But it was a proposed pipeline that was initially slated to cross a non-tribal community upriver from one of their primary water sources. They didn't like it. They threw kind of a big fit. So the pipeline got rerouted just above tribal lands and their water reserves and aquifers. And so, of course, we stepped in and said, hey, this is a danger, not just for us, but everybody else downstream from us, where it crosses these waterways and has the potential to contaminate these aquifers. So, you know, we do recognize that some tribes have oil interests, and we respect their ability to take care of their people however they see fit. But we also know that we're very much stewards of the environment and have been in this area for a long time. So we do a lot of environmental work, water law. We get heavily into educational opportunities, for example, like this interview where we can chat a little bit and have an informal conversation about the type of work we do and why it's important. We get into Indian child welfare issues. We very much recognize that our future generations need to be considered, need to be respected and taken care of and nurtured so that we can cultivate the best opportunity for them to simply live according to their traditions and their cultural identities. So that kind of leads us to another area where we get into a lot of sovereignty issues and treaty rights. We do a lot of treaty right enforcement. A lot of people don't remember that treaties are kind of the supreme law of the land right next to the Constitution. And we have seen varying interpretations of those treaty rights, but most recently the McGirt decision in Oklahoma affirmed some of those treaty rights to the surprise of quite a few people, including a lot of tribes who expected the Supreme Court to rule in a different direction. The issues that we take on, as I mentioned before, are guided by these priorities and kind of help us determine what is going to be the most impactful. We have a couple programs that help us keep an eye out for that kind of thing. If we see state or federal cases from the outset that appear to be a big enough issue that they are going to appear before the Supreme Court, one of our projects, the Tribal Supreme Court Project, kind of helps not just our clients, but anybody who are involved, tribes or other legal advocates who are involved in those cases, prepare and strategize and hopefully put forward the best possible legal argument when they do get to that point. Because as we mentioned before, it can either really benefit all the tribes or it could really hurt all the tribes. And so while tribes don't always agree on everything, when it comes to our sovereignty, I think most tribes are in agreement and want to see us just simply be able to live the way we want to live.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit about the past now. What has Indian law been like in the 18th, 19th centuries? 19th, 20th centuries. And then what are some of the biggest cases which North has handled in the past?
Okay, well, it's a pretty complicated relationship with the U.S. I'll try and give sort of a nutshell explanation of how we got to where we are today. Before the U.S. was even the U.S., there was obviously indigenous people here in this continent, some with relationships with each other, some beneficial, some not so beneficial. But as exploration started happening more and more, many foreign governments realized that they needed the help of the indigenous populations in order to just simply survive. I'm going to try not to get into too many tangents on this question.
Tangents are what we're all about here in politics. Yeah.
So, for example, I'm Northern Arapaho and Seneca. I come from two different tribes that are totally different culturally. One's on the East Coast, one's on the Northern Plains. It's classic culture. But on the Seneca side, you know, when the U.S. was considering breaking off from the British government and any sort of foreign influence to start their own democracy, you could say. They looked to tribes to help them with this new war, right? This revolutionary war. And some tribes assisted the U.S., the Senecas, I think we sided with the British for a lot of different reasons. One of them being that they just simply treated us better than the Americans did. They treated us like sovereigns. They appreciated our cooperation and our assistance. We knew the area. So we've had a few battles with George Washington. In English, I think we called him the destroyer of towns, because during one of his campaigns, he just went through leveling Seneca villages who didn't even fight. They weren't resisting him, but he burned orchards, he burned fields, he burned houses and longhouses.
Wow.
Anyway, so time goes on. The U.S. now has this situation as they start to expand and grow. They are now coming into more and more contact with different tribal communities. And there was a lot of things happening in their favor. You know, disease was decimating a lot of tribal populations. Wars were consuming a lot of resources. And so they found it in their best interest to treat with tribes, to engage in cooperative agreements that said, we will concede X amount of land in exchange for education, for goods, for health services, things like that. And some of those treaties have been horribly violated as time went on. Others are still currently being recognized. In fact, the Senecas, one of our treaties, one of the provisions was what we call annuity cloth. As part of the provisions, they would provide fabric, X amount of yards of fabric to individual tribal members. And every year you can still go down to the tribal building and the government gives, I don't know how many hundreds of yards of fabric to the tribe so they can give it out to the tribe. So, you know, it's more symbolic than anything, but it's nice to see that some treaty provisions are being honored. So as time goes on, you know, various decisions that had wound their way through state and federal courts to the Supreme Court really needed to be interpreted. Where does the jurisdiction of the U.S. lie versus a state versus a tribe? Who has jurisdiction over individual tribal members? And that body of law has evolved. You know, certain decisions defined what they call the tribal trust relationship, where initially it was, I think it was the Marbury versus Madison decision, where the Supreme Court said, well, tribes are wards of the U.S. government, and we got to take care of them. As time goes on, that's happened in various ways. There was termination policies and then restoration policies. There's been tribes that were fully recognized at one point and then unrecognized for no apparent reason. Some of NARF work includes helping those tribal communities get recognition again, because it does yield a benefit of various sorts, healthcare and tribal and federal dollars to assist with housing and things like that. So the long story short, federal Indian law has definitely evolved and grown over the last 200 years. For a little while in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, we were seeing some pretty adverse decisions towards tribal sovereignty. But the current court has recently recognized various aspects of treaty rights. And in fact, this last decision with McGirt really was a benefit and a blessing to tribes, because it just simply stated, hey, we see these treaty rights and it's really up to the U.S. to abide by them, where we have horribly failed in the past. And so they're still trying to figure out what that means in terms of criminal jurisdiction. Luckily, the state of Oklahoma has worked with various tribes there. There's a lot of tribes in Oklahoma, and in varying ways, sometimes good, sometimes not so good. But, you know, like most neighbors, I think tribes try to be good neighbors and want to be good neighbors with their states and figure it out in a way that's, you know, beneficial to the people on the reservation and in the surrounding communities. So second part of your question, some significant cases that NARF has engaged in. You know, there's literally hundreds of cases that I think it's estimated we've represented over 300 of the 574 recognized tribes at some point.
Wow.
Ways. Yeah. We've seen significant victories in water law, especially in the last 20 years. Some of that litigation has carried on for two and three decades. Water law is really about who has what rights to the water and in what capacity and in how much. Obviously, you know, somebody upstream could divert the whole river and now nobody downstream has any use and benefit. And so it can get very complicated very fast. And when you start talking indigenous rights to water, well, we definitely recognize that there has to be cooperation when it comes to water law. We're not looking to take all the water, but we should be recognized for having been stewards of those waterways for so long. And sometimes it's just simply preserving maybe a fishing right. Some salmon populations have been decimated for some tribes, and they just simply want to see those salmon continue because they have relationships with those salmon. They have their part of their creation stories or their origin stories. They have ceremonies surrounding that salmon food source for certain tribes, especially in the Pacific Northwest. And so, like I said before, I think they're just trying to figure it out. We really appreciate the work that we've done around the enforcement of treaty rights. Sometimes it's as simple as the enforcement of the ability for tribes to be stewards over their own natural resources, whether it's oil or gas under the ground, or it's timber above ground, or it's waterways, or whether it's certain elk or caribou herds. They just simply want to continue having that relationship with some of those natural resources. We've done some really important work when it comes to helping tribes get recognized again. That's been some big issues. We've done a lot of significant work when it comes to Indian child welfare. Kind of a quick primer on that. You know, we've recognized that our children are very literally our future. They will become the new culture carriers, the language speakers. They'll protect our ceremonies, but they have to be engaged and they have to be around it. And when the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed, it was recognized through a lot of study, a lot of research that, you know, Indian children were put up for adoption or sometimes sold at like a 20 or 30% higher rate than non-Indian minors. They were removed for all kinds of reasons. A lot of it was cultural misunderstanding. A lot of it was perceived poverty. Our lifestyles and our lifeways can often be very different than traditional Western culture. And so all these misconceptions led to children being removed from not just their families, but from their entire tribal community. And so the Indian Child Welfare Act was enabled through an act of Congress to protect these children and place a number of priorities on their placement. So if a child was removed for some reason, they had to try and find an immediate or extended family member who they could be placed with. And then if not, then at least a tribal member who they could be placed with. And then if that was all exhausted, then they could be placed with a foster situation that wasn't non-tribal. But it's interesting how much, you know, I'd like to think some well-intentioned people now fight that policy. Again, because they don't understand how much our culture means to us and to tribal communities in general, you know. So when it comes to significant victories, you know, every year we have cases where even small movements in the right directions are considered significant. I invite you guys to definitely check out our website. We put out a legal review and an annual review in digital formats that kind of list our current stuff. Sometimes we take a step back and look at some of the stuff in the past that has got us to that certain case or that certain moment. But there's tons of information, more than, you know, I've been with NAR for about a year and a half, and I'm still learning, all the incredible things that we've done over the last 50 years.
Wow.
You know, one of the reasons I went to law school was because I knew I wanted to serve tribal communities. I thought I would go back and be an attorney or in-house counsel for my own tribes. But I sort of ended up on this nonprofit path and ended up at NARF. So that's been fantastic so far. It's really exciting.
That's great.
Oh, yeah.
I have a question for you. For some of us, we took American history last year, the AP course, so it's called APUSH. And we learned about, obviously, the treatment of Native Americans and how they were slowly pushed westward. What are your thoughts on the Carlisle School, being set up in the late 1800s?
You know, I think you'd get just as many different responses depending on who you talk to, because everybody's got an opinion about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
For some tribal members, it was devastating. It often led to death. I mean, we just repatriated our own tribe. I think three young children who had died at Carlisle and buried there. And thankfully, the government is assisting tribes in bringing those children home to where they were, where they came from. You know, some of these chiefs had sent some of their children there in the hopes that they would be educated in the Western ways and that they would be able to navigate some of those relationships as future tribal leaders. But in terms of the negative, there was some plenty, you know, awful stories about what happens to an individual when they're ripped from any culture that they know. Imagine being removed from your own community at the age of 5 or 6 and taken to Mexico, you know, a foreign language that you don't speak, ways that are totally different. Now the food is probably bomb, right? But everything else is going to be total culture shock and pretty horrible. So survivors of those residential schools and those boarding schools, it's mixed. You know, I've really heard a few tribal elders say, yeah, it was hard and it was awful, but I have what I have because I had to, you know. But for others, and then, of course, it was very, very negative. And then there was kind of a difference, too, between like Catholic-run boarding schools and government-run boarding schools. Some of those nuns that colonized institutionalized religion was very, very hard on our culture. And some tried what they needed to do to survive. They kind of created a hybrid of religions and ceremonies, whereas others have started to re-embrace their own traditional religions. And for some, they had completely rejected Christianity and just continued to do what they had been given by, you know, creator or grandfather, however you want to call them.
Yeah, no doubt is a big show of forced American assimilation of Native culture.
Absolutely.
I'd like to ask about a specific case that I found when I was researching NARF, U.S. versus Washington. Do you happen to be familiar with it?
I am not. Tell me that. What was that one about again?
I believe that it was about the state of Washington upholding a treaty that the U.S. government had made with local Native American tribes regarding the rights to fish in certain areas, on private property.
Yeah, you're correct. I do actually know a little bit about it. There's a handful of treaty rights cases that have come through in the last 5 or 10 years. And that one has to do a little bit with the subsistence fishing that some of those tribal communities simply wanted to engage in. There's been similar cases. There was a crow case where a tribal member was hunting outside of the reservation, a crow tribal member. But interestingly, it was still within the boundaries of the treaty that was signed back in the 19th century. And the court came back and said, hey, this treaty allows them to leave the reservation and hunt on these, even though they've been ceded, they were still considered tribal lands because that's where they'd been hunting for millennia. And they enforced that right for tribes to still engage in that. Now, that particular case, the state of Wyoming has gotten a little funny about their requirements for tribal members hunting within those tree lands. So there's still a little bit of a fight. But in terms of that Washington case, you know, I think those are big victories. You know, it's the tribes aren't asking for, you know, unfettered access and commercial, you know, quantities. They just simply want to engage in the fishing that they've been doing. And they're a small population compared to off-reservation populations who go out and fish and fish and fish. They just want to be part of that process. There's a case right now in Alaska where those Gwich'in tribes are trying to protect one of the largest caribou herds in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They have history with those caribou. It's one of the last large breeding grounds for that huge herd of caribou. And the EPA and this administration wants to just simply go in and start mining and tearing up the place and disrupt the balance that has been there for thousands of years. So the tribes get involved because, again, we do see ourselves as stewards of those animals, those brothers and sisters, those beings that are part of some of our stories. But as far as the details of Washington, I'm not super familiar, but did you have something specific about that case?
What I found so notable and frankly shocking about it was that, like you said, the Native Americans weren't asking for anything that was outrageous. It was perfectly within the bounds of reason. Right. But in fact, the state of Washington refused to uphold the ruling, and Judge Bolt had to order the U.S. Coast Guard and federal law enforcement to force the state of Washington to comply. And I just found this to be shocking and perhaps emblematic of some of the systemic racisms which the Native community has to deal with. And so I was going to use this as a segue into the present day, some of the challenges which the Native community is dealing with right now. I was just wondering if you had anything to say about that.
Yeah, well, like you mentioned, racism seems to be the foundation and root of a lot of the issues that face Native Americans. You know, right now there's tribes on the Great Lakes who try to harvest wild rice or engage in some of their tribal fishing practices, and they're getting shot at and they're getting harassed. And where was it? It might have been in Maine over on the East Coast where they were some tribal fishermen were trying to engage in a little bit of commercial fishing just to because that's their livelihood, like many fishermen on the East Coast. Non-tribal fishermen were pulling up their lobster traps. They were creating long line blockades of boats to prevent them from leaving certain areas. It's horrible. And it's really just, you know, our view versus the commodification of natural resources. You know, our value structures are often very different when we approach, you know, how we view wealth and how we view the way that we want to live, you know. I'm trying to think of some very specific, you know, the pipelines are a very interesting topic, because some of those communities right off the reservation, those border towns, they call them, can be hotbeds of racism. They've just had varying perspectives of indigenous peoples for generations, you know, and racism seems to be taught. It's not something that kids are born with. And so generation after generation are adding fuel to that fire, and it just continues to complicate things, and it ends up in court for us. You know, luckily we can do what we do because, you know, we We are a nonprofit law firm, which sounds a little weird to a lot of people, but it allows us to represent a lot of tribal communities who couldn't afford this high-level legal advocacy because they just don't have the economic means to, you know. We can take on a case and stick with it for two or three decades and see it through to the very end through the generous support of individual donors, foundations, sometimes wealthy tribes. There are a lot of people who recognize the injustices that are occurring in Indian country and just simply want to help. And so we fill a very specific void. It's very difficult for a law firm to take on a case for a client that they know is going to stretch on for 8 or 10 years and cost them $5 or $6 million over the course of that 5 years with knowing that they probably won't see that $5 or $6 million in time and expenses ever paid back. But that's partly why NARF's role is so critical, because there's just simply not another firm out there like ours.
Definitely. I think that it's clear that NARF is an incredibly important organization. It's been involved in many landmark cases throughout history. If you fills a niche that otherwise wouldn't have gone to filled. I'd like to talk a little bit about the present day specifically. Okay. First of all, not necessarily pertaining to the legal code, but what are some of the issues which Native Americans face today?
Boy, it can vary widely, you know, depending on the tribal community, depending on where they're at, depends on their relationship within that state, depends on their economic development. Some tribes are doing extremely well. You know, they've got great sources of economic revenue. Sometimes it's driven by gaming. Sometimes it's driven by natural resources. Some are engaged in a lot of industry. You know, for some tribes, they're paying for their own infrastructure, and they're paying for their health centers and their medical centers. They're paying for their fire departments and their police force. They cover a lot of elderly programs and youth programs. Sometimes they have their own schools, you know. For other tribes that don't have those economic engines, it's a lot more of a struggle. You know, they face poverty, huge rates of unemployment. Couple that with the racism for border towns, you know, with border towns, it's hard for somebody to go work on the border town if, you know, the majority of the people there are racist and don't want to employ you. There's diabetes issues and alcoholism, like many communities. It can just vary wildly from tribe to tribe. Even with tribes that are doing fairly well, you know, they can often have strained relationships with the state of Oklahoma. Right now, that McGirt decision, which protected and asserted a lot of tribal sovereignty, still is being defined. But the oil and gas industry there is very afraid of what that means and whether they have to now start to comply with tribal regulations when it comes to oil and gas drilling on tribal lands. And just the other day, under this administration, the Environmental Protection Agency came out with a statement saying that the state of Oklahoma doesn't have to comply with tribal regulations. Totally, you know, totally adverse to tribal sovereignty and their ability to simply take care of their own lands. So that's going to end up in the courts pretty dang quick, and we'll see where it goes. But like a lot of things that this administration has done, I think it will be overturned and undone just because it's unjust, based on a lot of racist policy and the lack of recognizing that tribes really are sovereigns and should be the respective as such. You know?
Does the EPA have a leg to stand on when they say that the oil and gas industry doesn't have to comply with tribal regulations?
Well, like a lot of, they do. I mean, because they are the regulatory agency for a lot of things. You see some administrations, like the Obama administration, really set forth a lot of regulatory policies that protected certain areas and created national monuments and did all kinds of things that the oil and gas industry hated, or other extractive industries hated. And now they have an administration that is only about big business and corporations and making their friends wealthier and wealthier at whatever expense. And so a lot of those Obama era policies, environmental policies, have been rolled back and diminished, if not overturned. And here we are, you know, ARF is bipartisan. We've sued administrations on both sides of the aisle. If it infringes on our sovereignty. But again, you know, it remains to be seen. A lot depends
on
provisions. I think at the end of the day, it will end up court and it will be beneficial to the tribes, because every state that has tribal communities within it have all tried in varying ways to attack tribal sovereignty and on varying levels. And sometimes they win, a lot of times they don't. So it definitely keeps NARF busy, that's for sure.
Yeah, I certainly wish them luck. I have a specific question, a little bit related to the election coming up. I noticed that voting seems to be quite a big priority for NARF. It was, there were numerous posts regarding it on the website. Can you tell me a little bit about what NARF is doing related to voting currently? Sure.
So, you know, NARF has sort of been really engaged in voting only in the last maybe 10 to 15 years. There were some tribal members who tried to vote. One was a veteran. You know, he'd gone to Vietnam. He had been wounded. He had served a couple tours. If anybody deserves the right to participate in that political process, it's an American veteran, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was disenfranchised. He was turned away a couple times, and he went to his tribe looking for help. And then the tribe approached us and we thought, hey, how often is this happening? So they started to look into it, and other orgs were kind of doing the same thing. And through a lot of research, a lot of surveys, a lot of polling, they realized there were huge issues when it comes to just voting rights in general. There were issues with polling places or the lack of polling places. There's issues with voter intimidation and redistricting. The gerrymandering in some tribal communities is obscene. Because if they were all unified in one district, those local communities would see a lot more representation on school boards, on the city government level, on the state level, and they just, you know, they weren't having it. So it's been a hot button issue for sure. And NARF leads what's called the Native American Voting Rights Coalition, which is comprised up of dozens of organizations similar to ours. Voting rights organizations, tribal communities, academics, legal advocates, other social justice, racial equity type attorneys, to simply find and identify the challenges for certain communities and then address them accordingly. And anytime you have an election cycle, especially one as critical as this one, it's going to be all hands on deck for NARF especially. So we've had five or six voting rights cases. Some have been very successful. Others are ongoing. We're going to kind of move into more of the gerrymandering and redistricting in some areas like South Dakota, where some of these state races are decided by a few hundred votes. A tribal community can absolutely make a difference, but when they've been told for generations and decades that their vote doesn't matter, it doesn't count, they don't have any representation, they don't have a voice, it's very hard to overcome some of those challenges and get those tribal communities to realize that they do have a voice and they should have a say. So it's been a pretty huge push for us. We've received a lot of funding for our efforts and we've seen a lot of successes so far. We just, you know, hope to keep it going. I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about the Washington football team in the NFL?
That's another hot button issue for sure. So, of course, obviously, we're glad that they've changed their stance. They were so opposed to that, to recognizing that it was a disparaging term, that it was born out of racism, that it was born out of very, very horrible historical experiences for some tribal communities. You know, and obviously they had their side. They had some tribal input from different Native peoples over the decades and stuff. But at the end of the day, if the vast majority of tribal peoples feel like it is a racial slur, then it's a racial slur. You can't tell another person how to feel. Oftentimes in debates, especially when it comes to things like theology or philosophy or politics, you try to remove the emotion out of it because you can't debate emotion. You can only debate facts. You can debate positions or policies and potential results. But at the end of the day, if it's born out of racism, then it's probably racist. So we're glad they, you know, this time has been a very, very difficult time. But like most civil justice issues and civil justice movements, they're often born out of just horrible things that have happened, as we've seen in the last 5 or 6 months. But we're grateful, you know, that if it's time, it's finally time. So we still see a few schools, high schools, colleges, and things that have indigenous mascots. Sometimes the relationships with the tribal communities nearby are fine, you know. Who was it that had a little input from one of the local tribes? I'm forgetting right now, but you know, if that tribe who's nearby wants to give them, I think, for example, University of Utah and the Utes, the Northern Ute tribe is right there. They've given their blessing to the University of Utah to use that sort of Native imagery and the Ute name. and that's between them, you know. But I'm just glad that the time has come for the Redskins to finally go the way of the world.
I certainly think it's long past due. I actually have a bit of a personal question on a related note.
Sure.
A local high school nearby me is called the Watching Hills Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could tell me whether or not this would be potentially offensive or not. I'm sharing my screen. Are you able to see it?
Yeah, I can.
you mentioned that it's usually between the local tribe and the school. Right. I'm not knowledgeable about what that situation is, although I do remember a few years ago, some students from this school were attempting to change the name. Yeah. I'm wondering if you can provide any insight into this, or is it more of a local issue?
Yeah, it's definitely a local issue. Where is that school located? What state is that?
New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, interesting is, so they've got a sort of a logo or a symbol, a caricature of a warrior wearing a classic plains bonnet, right? Those plains bonnets, those war bonnets were worn mostly in the Northern Plains, the Dakotas, Wyoming, Oklahoma. The culture and dress of those tribes in New Jersey and on the Eastern coast were very different.
Hmm.
But when it comes to, so I think that's problematic for sure. Wanting to embody that fighting warrior spirit, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. You know, you see Vikings as mascots. The problem with a lot of these mascots is when you see imagery devolving to just characterizations of a culture. So if they've got a mascot wearing a bonnet and doing war whoops, so, you know, those are based on some very real spiritual and ceremonial outfits and headpieces and headdresses. That's the problem. You know, if they found a way to reconcile that somehow without devolving our culture into something like that, then I'm sure there wouldn't be a lot of issues with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I see. So it seems that the bigger issue is just a characterization of aspects within Native culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Stereotyping, mischaracterizing our culture, devolving sacred things into something that's a parody of what it actually is. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Got it.
Yeah, because warriors isn't a racial slur by any means. But you're talking about a whole culture. You know, you got to be respectful of what that culture is.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for answering that question. I've actually had it for quite a while.
Okay, good.
So this is a bit of a happy moment for me. I'm able to stumble across a little nugget of knowledge here.
All right, good.
If you don't mind getting into a little bit of political stuff, I'd like to briefly touch on the Supreme Court battle and what Amy Coney Barrett's likely nomination would mean specifically in the context of the Native American community.
Okay. Well, that's always hard to predict, you know. I think, and I can't speak on behalf of NARF because...
Of course.
Take a position on any nominee. But interestingly, Justice Gorsuch, for example, he was nominated not too long ago. And he's a relatively conservative Republican. I think when it comes to most other issues, he's very concerning for the far left or the left even. And a lot of people raised their eyebrows because we thought Indian country was going to be in trouble with this conservative majority. But interestingly, he came out of a federal district court in Montana, which had already seen a lot of Indian law. And so there was a few legal practitioners who said, well, just wait, let's see what happens, because he very well could educate his fellow justices on a lot of Indian rights issues.
Yes.
We didn't see any real huge, we saw some, you know, decently beneficial stuff, but it wasn't until McGirt, which had already been pushed back once, that we thought, oh my gosh, it's coming and it's going to be horrible. But then the decision hit and it was mind blowing. It was the single biggest decision in the last 50 years, giving and protecting treaty rights. He literally wrote in his opinion, the U.S. needs to start respecting tribal treaties and their relationships with the U.S. And we're not going to do that now. It was pretty incredible. And so, you know, it's concerning for women's rights. It's concerning for all kinds of things like how the court is, for example, corporate donations to elections, things like that. But for tribal communities, we're kind of breathing a sigh of relief. Now, our biggest, my biggest concern with this newest possible nominee is her lack of experience. You know, I've heard arguments for and against her, that she's been a great professor of law at Notre Dame, and she's done all these other things. She seems like a nice enough person. Some of her religious values scare me. Some of her conservative values scare me. And it definitely scares a lot of people who don't want to see things like Roe versus Wade overturned, because it probably will be under her. So, you know, it's just hard to say. And again, these are my personal concerns, and I probably don't know enough about it, I probably should, but yeah, we can only see what happens, what the next steps are.
Yeah, we'll have to hope that she surprises us, much like Gorsuch did with the Oklahoma case. I believe that his reasoning for supporting the Oklahoma case was because he believed in, the exact term is eluding me right now, but believed in carrying out the original meaning of the Constitution of legal texts. And so I'm assuming that applies to the numerous treaties that the U.S. government has made with the Native American tribes over the years.
Yeah, and I want to say it's something like he's an originalist or something, or a
Originalism sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, and that can be good and bad. You know, I think Justice Thomas considers himself sort of a, he'll take the very literal wording of the original language and apply it despite the context being, couldn't possibly have been imagined 200 years ago, you know. Anyway, so I don't know what'll happen with that. Well, we can only hope we're surprised. I think a few of, you know, Trump has nominated and confirmed an incredible amount of federal judges across the board, and a handful have really surprised, I think, him and his administration, because I think he thought they would all just roll over and do whatever his attorneys wanted them to. But luckily, there's still some conservatives who feel like he's not the best representation of their party and their values, and hopefully they rule accordingly. You know,
it appears that the American legal system is still alive and well, preserving the checks and balances that it was meant to complete.
Yeah. That's, I've got some strong personal opinions about the state of affairs right now. But I do have a stop at 3:30. So I don't know if there's questions from anybody else tuning in, or is it just the few of us who are on right now?
No, it would just be us. Sorry, I don't mean to keep you any longer.
That's great. I wasn't sure how long you wanted to go, so this is
good.
This is actually much longer than I expected. I've genuinely enjoyed this conversation.
Good.
Thank you so much. My last question is, going forward in the future, both at an individualistic and at a governmental level, what can be done to help the Native community?
Well, I think the first step is doing what we're doing here, you know, talking about the issues, getting educated about what they are, and finding out how you can help. Sometimes it's just simply talking to your neighbors and helping them learn a little bit about what those issues are and where kind of the false narratives are, you know, letting them know that, hey, this isn't to be feared, but we can figure this out as good neighbors and come to some kind of resolution. So that's always the first step I advise people, is just learn about the communities where you're at, you know, find out what they are and see how you can help. Sometimes it's a conversation that is hard and difficult and may not have an easy answer, but there's got to be resolution, you know, if we're going to find an amicable way to overcome some of this stuff. You know, after here in Colorado, actually, there was a horrible massacre, the Wounded Knee Massacre. And it was awful, you know, mostly women and children who were killed, babies being swung against rocks. It was as horrible as you can get. Genitalia being cut off and mounted onto the saddle horns of these U.S. soldiers. Just blatant war crimes, you know, and it would have been swept under the rug if it wasn't for a group of humanitarian-minded women in New York City, whose one of their husbands happened to run one of the largest news outlets, heard about it, was horrified appropriately, and got people talking about it. Pretty soon, other women and their congressional husbands heard about it, and there were some inquiries, and it wasn't resolved as it should have been, but at least the public became aware of something that could have very well faded into history. So that's part of it, you know, just getting out there and learning about stuff seeing how you can help.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Once again, we really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Marcus, I believe that's everything.
Yeah, I liked it. I had fun listening.
Excellent. Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, good.
And enjoy the rest of your night.
All right, you too. Thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
See ya.